Hi, and welcome back to Foreign Office. I'm Michael Weiss, Director of Special Investigations at the Free Russia Foundation. This week, we are joined by an institution, if I may say so, a longtime friend and colleague, the former Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, former U.S. Ambassador to Poland, Dan Fried. And I call him an institution because Dan and I often have telephone calls talking about the state of the world, the state of, well, given his former bailiwick, sanctions policy, and so on and so forth. And I just wanted to get his perspective on the Biden administration's approach to foreign policy as a whole, what seems to be a kind of emerging trend line with respect to its engagement with Moscow, and just a whole host of other things, including, by the way, the situation of politics and culture in his former parish of Poland. Dan, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I can't believe this is the first time because our last phone call last week, it just occurred to me that we talk so regularly that I had assumed I had interviewed you already formally for a public audience. But no, it's an honor, and thanks for making time to do this.
Pleasure. Don't know about the honor, but it is a pleasure, Michael. Go over some of this good stuff.
Let me just ask you this. Of course, I know some of the answers to what you're going to say before you say them, but that's why this is for a public audience. You know, you served in the Obama administration. You were there during the reset with Russia. You were then the architect of the sanctions regime that was put together in the wake of Russia's invasion and occupation of Crimea and then its dirty war in Ukraine. You've seen how the sausage gets made. In fact, you were one of the the principal makers of the sausage, if I may say so. What did you learn or take away from not just U.S. policymaking with respect to Moscow, but also the Russian response to that policymaking? And what are some of the lessons that have been learned, or better say, not learned from the Obama era that have now kind of percolated into the Biden era?
Well, let's start with the Bush administration.
That's right. I forgot to mention you. That's why you're an institution. You go back so far.
The arc of U.S.-Russia relations under Bush and Obama was remarkably parallel, rather similar. Very different presidents. Both started out reaching out to Putin. Both achieved something. It wasn't an empty policy. Both failed. That is, Putin and Putin's Russia wasn't what either administration thought. And both, I would say, in facing up to that failure, were honorable, by which I mean, instead of doubling down and pretending the failure didn't happen, they recognized it. Now, the failure in the case of the failure break, so to speak, for the Bush administration was the Russo-Georgian War. And after that, I think it was October 2008, Condi Rice gives a speech at the German Marshall Fund, which is worth looking at because she nails the dilemma of U.S.-Russia policy and the problem Putin has. And she basically says, Putin can be part of the world or he can game the world. We shouldn't let him do both. She learned that lesson the hard way. We all did. Obama comes in and his Russia person, Mike McFaul, launches the reset. Now, I know Michael. You know Mike McFaul. He's a deeply knowledgeable, honorable person. He's no fool. And I told him at the beginning of the administration, I was a holdover for the first few months of the Obama administration. I was still assistant secretary. And we had a conversation about him. And I told him, Michael, you're going to fail. I understand why you're doing the reset. I get it. You're going to fail, and you're going to fail for the same reasons we fail, because Putin isn't interested in the kind of productive relationship that you seek. But I'm not going to bust you, because you have to try, right? You're going to try. Just remember that we tried too. And later, he remembered that conversation and said, you know, right, but I'm not sorry they tried. Obama, after the invasion, after Putin's attack on Ukraine, the invasion of Crimea, the attack on the Donbas, reverses 30 years of American post-Cold War military drawdown and leads NATO to send combat forces to the Baltic states and Poland, battalion each country, and in addition throws in a U.S. armored brigade sent to Poland on a rotational basis, not permanent a la Germany, but heel to toe rotation means there's always a U.S. armored brigade in Poland. Now, that is a very big deal.
Yeah.
We never considered that in the Bush administration after the Russo-Georgian War, but Obama did it. I never thought he got enough credit. Now, what does that tell you about the arc of U.S.-Russia relations under Obama? They start out with the reset. They got something, you know, some arms control deals. So did we in the Bush administration. But when they were faced with Putin's condition for good relations, that is, I get to commit any kind of repression I want inside Russia and get to beat up on my neighbors, the ones I consider belong to me, like Georgia or Ukraine. Both administrations refused those conditions. No American president, with the exception of Donald Trump, could have ever accepted those kind of terms. Although I will say at the height of detente, Nixon got close, but that's a different issue. We can go back into memory lane if you want.
I want to interject now. I mean, so you refer to the Russo-Georgian War of 2008 as sort of the Damascene moment for the Bush administration. That's at the very end of that administration, right? I mean, now, granted, there were other priorities, 9/11, the global war on terror, then the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And yeah, I mean, we all remember, you know, Bush's now notorious comment that he looked into Putin's soul.
He looked into his eyes and got a glimpse of
his looked
soul.
Into his eyes and he saw it. Exactly.
I was there at that meeting.
And famously, Putin showed up for that meeting wearing a crucifix, knowing very well how that would resonate with a deeply evangelical Christian president, which it certainly did. I also remember the now late Colin Powell saying, that's funny, I looked into his eyes and I saw KGB, KGB, KGB.
All right. But let me tell you another story about Bush and Putin.
Go on.
So 2003, early, Bush goes to London and it's all about the Iraq war.
Right.
Okay. You know, that there are demonstrations in the street. But Bush and Tony Blair have a meeting and they're talking, both of them get ahead of their advisors. They start talking about Putin and they both agree that Putin is not the person they thought. He's far more authoritarian. He's taking Russia in an authoritarian dark direction. 2003, this is right. Early. And this was, I can assure you, it was not in his talking point.
Yep.
Both of them were right, and they were both on to Putin long before many people thought they were. That didn't mean Bush stopped trying to work with Russia, but he was, you know, Bush is the only major political figure I've ever met who tries to appear less savvy than he actually is. That was part of his style. He hated pretension, including in himself. But he and Tony Blair had Putin's number. I was impressed. So I'm telling you this story so many years later. I was a backbencher in the meeting, and I thought to myself, wow.
That's 2003. 2004, you begin to see the so-called color revolutions break out.
And that's, Putin blamed us. He thought we did it. That, for him, was the red line we had crossed. It wasn't bringing the Baltics into NATO that Bush decided to do. It was the color revolutions.
Oh, that's interesting. I want you to follow up on, okay, finish your thought, but I want to ask you about that, about NATO expansion, because that's been one of the sort of big talking points of the kind of neorealist set in Washington, that America has gobbled up Russia's near abroad. I mean, as if joining NATO was a sort of American diktat. People don't seem to understand the bureaucratic hoops that a country has to jump through in order to accede to but we'll get to that. Finish your thought. I interrupted you. I didn't mean to this time. Just
okay. So Putin thinks that the Americans somehow engineered the so-called Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, by which more or less dysfunctional governments that Putin could dominate were replaced by pro-Western governments that got a lot more done. He thought we did that. We didn't. We're not that good. It always struck me as faintly ridiculous that with all this money we were spending in Iraq, we couldn't get anything done. And with no budget at all, somehow we're engineering revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia. Nonsense. We were surprised by this. But this is an old Soviet mentality. I mean, I could tell you stories from the Stalin era that Stalin felt the same way. There was no such thing as spontaneous. It was always orchestrated. It was always manipulated. It was always an operation. Yeah. Putin thinks that way. He blamed us. Neither Bush nor Obama nor their administrations were willing to give Putin a free hand in Russia's neighborhood. It may be Russia's neighborhood, but you know, and this comes to your next question about NATO enlargement. Yeah, Russia has interests in Ukraine. You know who has more interests in Ukraine?
Right.
Ukrainians. It's their country. And the United States was perfectly, if not happy, accepting of a pro-Russian leader, Yanukovych, who had been democratically elected. He was elected.
Right. There's nothing you can do about it.
Right. He was elected because he beat his predecessors because they were seen as ineffective. And we had no problem with Yanukovych.
As a reporter, I could tell you stories. 2014, I was in Kyiv. I was meeting with former ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt, who, and I guess—
he's great.
Yeah, but I guess I'm giving something away. He said, look, you know, we're getting messages from the State Department. You cannot refer to them as pro-Russian separatists, or you cannot refer to them as Russian irregulars. There was a very clear euphemism that had to be employed at all levels of American diplomacy in Ukraine that basically denied the obvious, which is that Russia had gone to war with Ukraine. Now, this referred to the East, right, in Donbass. Crimea was already a fait accompli. But I remember listening to this saying, well, gee, it doesn't sound very much like America wants to engineer a fight with Moscow over Ukraine. If anything, America is prostrate to try and de-escalate the situation and to give Putin some kind of face-saving measure to allow him to carry on this lie that in fact, he hadn't invaded when he had.
Yeah, well, that didn't last.
No, it didn't. But I mean, that was sort of the stated policy. I mean, again, this came from the ambassador, you know, who very much knew what little green men were in Donbass. So, you know, I'm always amazed at the conflation of, I mean, you say we're not that good. Another way of putting that is we're either incompetent or oblivious. The conflation of those qualities with grand conspiracy. But you're quite right. This is a very much a Soviet way of looking at the world, paranoid, and also a kind of Freudian projection, right? I mean, they're doing this kind of thing all the time, and they just assume we must be doing it as well. But yeah, look, I mean, you were making the point about the NATO enlargement, the accession of the Baltic states, which didn't upset him as much as has been made out, because you hear this argument all the time, right?
I've heard it before, during, and after the process of NATO enlargement.
Yes.
And it's always the same thing. We're being mean to poor Moscow by treating the countries that it abused, dominated through force, through violence, and kept poor by allowing them to join the institutions of a free Europe.
Right.
Which was, by the way, our original war aim in World War II, right? And I keep hearing the argument that somehow it's anti-Russian to treat these countries as countries, and they ought to be treated as creatures of Moscow, and that we ought to look at them through the prism of Moscow. Well, Russia never dominated Czechoslovakia until the end of World War II. That's a country not in Moscow's traditional sphere of domination, but a country in Central Europe.
Right.
But it doesn't even matter. These countries actually believe that they ought to determine their own future. And the notion that after the fall of the Iron Curtain, we would reestablish the line of the Iron Curtain as the demarcation line in Europe, in order to make Russia feel better about the failure of communism, would we have allowed Germany to maintain its control of Denmark so that they wouldn't feel so bad after 1945?
Well, it's the height of American arrogance and, dare I even say, American imperialism to tell countries, by the way, you haven't got any agency and we don't care what the will of your people is. We are carving up Europe with Russia, like it or not, right? I mean, what we're being accused of on a daily basis would be what we would be guilty of if we were to say, you don't have these sovereign rights to self-determination.
Well, I hear this over and over. But there's also a kind of historical patronizing attitude toward these countries.
Yeah.
If you think of Americans looking at Ukraine and thinking of it as kind of a silly country that has no right to exist, and there were Americans who did that, including some in the Obama administration, though not Tory and Nuland, not the people, not Tony Blinken, not Tory and Nuland, not any of the people Biden's picked up, but there were others. It's a little bit like, do you remember Neville Chamberlain's famous remark that Czechoslovakia was a faraway country of which we knew nothing?
Right.
When Chamberlain said that, Czechoslovakia had existed as a country for less time than Ukraine has existed now as an independent country. It was brand new.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the maps when Neville Chamberlain was growing up. Therefore, he never regarded it as a real country. And you cannot, that's not to excuse what he did at Munich, but it's to understand the mentality. Well, that same mentality governs people who look at these countries like Ukraine as silly countries.
Or inconvenient, more than silly.
Inconvenient, indeed. Right. But the Ukrainians are the ones that drove their own history. The United States was happy, not happy. We were satisfied with Yanukovych, only because he'd been democratically elected. His fall was not any of our doing. His fall was precipitated by the fact that Putin was asking him, Putin's puppet, to not just sign an association agreement with the EU that he had promised and that Ukrainian society overall supported. And that's how the Maidan, the demonstrations in Kyiv that ended up into basically a rebellion to throw him out of office started. Wasn't us. It was because of an association agreement between Ukraine and the EU, not even membership, an association agreement, because to Ukrainians, it represented a European future for them. That's what they want. And the question is, do they have agency? Now, American strategy in the years of its wisdom, starting a little bit with Teddy Roosevelt, but a lot more with Wilson, if you can forgive his dark side, meaning his racism. But Wilson understands that self-determination, however inconsistently applied, no matter how flawed, no matter how many weaknesses it has, is a stronger basis for stability than empires. And he wanted to put the U.S. on the side of such aspirations, which is a strong position. And I can tell you, that is not abstract idealism. It's canny foreign policy. It puts us, the United States, on the right side of history, if we mean it. Now, you could come back and say, yeah, but Wilson made a whole bunch of blunders. And I would say, that's true. And no strategy is protection against stupid. But as a grand strategy, it works. The alternative strategy is some version of power politics and spheres of influence. Well, that's what the United States, when it came to power, starting in 1918, determined it wouldn't do. Not because we thought we were too good, but because it suited our interests better.
Well, let me ask you something now, and this is a nice segue into the sort of second theme of this conversation. So we talk about self-determination of peoples and countries and, you know, creating alliances that are forged more in common values or democratic ideals and covenants.
Right.
And this all sounds great. And, you know, I don't think among us, so many things have been memory hold lately, particularly with the rise of social media. I shouldn't say this, but, you know, the 89 moment was a transformative and very optimistic moment. I mean, you know, Anne Applebaum has written a book about this. The kind of the other shoe dropping, if you like, is that, well, in fact, often those who we thought shared our values and were kind of natural, organic allies with the same kind of liberal democratic tropisms that we have, turn out to be quite the other thing, as John Le Carré would put it quaintly, or they morph into the other thing over time. You were ambassador to Poland. What you see taking place in Poland must be quite galling and disturbing to you. I mean, the erosion of civil society, kind of creeping authoritarianism in the ruling party. We could talk also about Hungary. I had Peter Krekow on the show a few weeks ago, who kind of gave a very forbidding picture of, I think he called it a soft authoritarianism under Viktor Orban, which has now become kind of a lodestone for the American right, which feels completely disillusioned by not just the Democratic Party and, you know, liberals as a cultural phenomenon, but by the very institutions of American liberalism that they think have failed. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in Europe, Poland free, and why maybe, you know, it's time for, if not second guessing the assumptions of 1989, at least being a little more clear-eyed about what we had hoped would happen versus what has actually transpired.
In 1989, I was the Polish desk officer, a relatively low-ranked job, but best possible time to be in that job ever. The expectations were extraordinarily low. No one other than myself, almost no one in the U.S. government in Washington thought anything serious or good would happen in 1989 in Poland or Central Europe. Our embassy did. Our embassy in Warsaw had it nailed, but nobody was listening to them except me. And it was a vindication of democratic values that were mixed up with the Polish national cause in the best possible way. The Poles saw their national cause in anti-communism as expressing itself through democratic means. And that was powerful. Patriotism and democracy were linked. And that was irresistible. And that power took them through the 1990s when they had to transform the ruins of a communist economy into a free market democracy. And they succeeded in so spectacularly that younger Poles now take for granted the prosperity of the country. Their GDP per capita tripled in one generation. That's Chinese levels of growth, only with democracy. Now, okay, you mentioned some of the political developments in Poland and Hungary. And then you mentioned the part of the American right, finding in Orban a kind of right-wing lodestone, you know, a mecca to which they, you know, they do now pilgrimages. And my answer to your overall question is it's not just Central Europe, but all of the West is grappling with issues of democracy. This is a sag in democratic self-confidence that we haven't seen since the 1930s. Now, it's something Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote, has been in my mind very much the past year or so. The line of good and evil goes through every nation and every human heart. In other words, it's not about perfection. And what about the challenges to democracy in the United States? We've got it too. France, you know, we thought that it was modern liberal democracy, and you have right-wing forces who trace their intellectual origins back to the anti-Dreyfus arts, right? Right through, you know, the French right, Vichy. I don't mean to make too much of it, but there is something there. And the American right, some of that is the Confederate ideology of John C. Calhoun. Let's call it what it is. It's the white man's republic. So I'll talk about Poland, but we've all got a problem.
But here's what worries me about the problem and you know, the danger of, we're always going through Weimar. We're always going through some, and that reminds me of the old Marx observation, I think, in the 18th Brumaire, you know, when man learns a new language, he's always looking to translate it back into the old. And history doesn't quite repeat itself in the exact iteration, right? And the thing that's dangerous about this current phenomenon is, you know, we can look at solidarity in Poland in the 80s, and we can see that as a fusion movement, if you like, of, on the one hand, you know, a kind of impoverished and put upon working class that are trying to break free of the fetters of totalitarianism. On the other hand, though, traditional Polish values, including and especially the suppressed Catholic Church and the power that that represented in sort of pushing back against Soviet communism. Today, and I mean, there was a very good piece in, I think, the New York Times Magazine about Orban's Hungary. You know, you're seeing, you know, you're seeing on the part of a kind of neo-reactionary, and you're right, this isn't just in the United States, this is everywhere. It is a weird, and I don't know the proper name for this, but it is, postmodern seems to encompass it both in the post-World War II sort of temporal aspect and also in the kind of weird hybrid, you know, or pastiche of different movements and philosophies. To put it simply, the new authoritarians will give you the church. In fact, many of them make that sort of part of the mantle of their regime. But they'll also give you other things, you know, gay rights can be weaponized, right? I mean, Orban is railing against the LGBT community. But, you know, in the United States, you had on the alt-right people like Milo Yiannopoulos and Donald Trump, even with his MAGA. It was sort of a broad church. We're not saying we're against these minorities, or we're not saying we're against things that you know, in the old kind of cultural new right sense of the word, were anathema. No, you can have all these things. It's a sort of a weird conflation of libertarianism on the one hand, but, you know, God and country on the other. And this is what makes it, it's not the kind of thing that can be easily explained to a reader of Reader's Digest, you know, in the old Susan Sontag formulation about understanding what communism is. This is something different and something we have not seen before. It's very appealing to a great number of people who might otherwise have been on our side in a kind of global struggle against bad political forces, but now have gone to the other side.
You're right. You're correct about some of the weird authoritarian right, which recalls, at least to me, the right's infatuation with, you know, interwar, not fascism so much, but, you know, Salazar in Portugal, right-wing authoritarianism. And the infatuation with Orban is almost a throwback to the West European and American right's fascination with interwar fascism. I'm not calling Orban a fascist, but I am saying that the turning away from liberal democracy, there are echoes of the past, and not in a good way. It's as if we were inoculated after 1945 from that kind of hard right, and the inoculation after three generations has worn off. Now, in Poland, I would be careful about painting too broad a brush. Civil society there is very strong. The liberals organized a pro-EU demonstration, basically overnight, had hundreds of thousands of people out all across the country, not just the big cities. The Hungarian opposition has united around a candidate who is not a Budapest liberal, but is a conservative Catholic from a small town who also believes in Europe and democracy. And Budapest liberals have told me he's great. Even though they don't agree with him, they think he's a credible carrier of Hungary's democratic opposition. In the Czech Republic, you had basically a center-right liberal coalition that included like the center-left Pirate Party and others winning an election unexpectedly. And of course, you had a liberal in Slovakia, Susana Čaputová, winning in 2019 against a kind of leftist populist government. So I think that Americans say, well, Poland and Hungary mean that Central Europe is all falling apart, are one, wrong about Central Europe, two, wrong to singularize Central, and three, not even right about Poland, though about Hungary more so. And by the way, one of the odd things about the Polish government policy is that it is staunch, principled, and effective in its support for example, the Belarus democracy movement. They are providing support, refuge, protection. They've done.
They're also not squishes on Russia.
Oh, they are.
Which is unusual for a populist party, whereas Orban is seen to be exactly that.
Yeah. You know, the Orban is far, he's pushed himself farther to the right than most of the Polish government. There are some on the right wing of this right wing government is in Orban territory, but not completely. And Polish society is one of the most pro-European societies around. Some of it is that they get money from the EU, but some of it is civilization. It's very interesting. During the pro-European demonstrations in Poland, the demonstrators found a veteran of the Warsaw Uprising in 1944 who spoke, who said, "Don't you think you can take Europe away from us? What do you think we fought for? What do you think we fought for?" Now, you know, these veterans of the 44 uprising against the Germans are lionized in Poland. It was a heroic, if lost, cause. So I understand that the point you made earlier, that there are some in America who say, well, we shouldn't have brought these countries into NATO and irritated Putin because they're all authoritarians anyway. They're an inferior type. Now, they don't put it quite that way, but pretty close. And you've read some of their work. But 1989, and I'll finally answer your question, because it was a fair question. 1989 was a kind of apotheosis of democracy, and it's great. Everything falls into place. The 20th century ends well. You know, Adam Michnik, the great Polish editor and Democratic dissident said, it's like a Hollywood movie. You know, you can't believe after all this horror, you have a happy ending. But then think of Tolstoy and the end of War and Peace. Everything ends up well, right? Except he writes an epilogue chapter where things aren't going so well. You know, new challenges are coming. The perfection they had attained, a kind of chorus of victory and triumph and apotheosis with the defeat of Napoleon, is going sour. And his point is not...
In Hollywood terms, you call that the retcon.
Right.
Right.
Tolstoy's...
Let's show the other side.
But yeah. What's Tolstoy's point? Is it that we should despair? Not at all. His point is the triumph was real, but life goes on.
I think there's a difference between a genuine triumph and triumphalism, making you blinkered.
Oh, sure.
And oblivious to the dangers that are still posed, not just from without, but from within.
Michael, are you asking me whether the Americans can be prone to triumphalism? You know, there's only one answer to that.
We were discussing before I clicked record on this. I'm halfway through writing a book on the GRU. And, you know, one of the leitmotifs of this book is, were it not for Stalin's paranoia and his murderous instinct, which was an extension of the paranoia, I don't believe that the West would have won the Cold War, at least in terms of the tools that were at the Soviet Union's disposal, both prior to the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which, as you know, was deeply disillusioning to a lot of people, but also not so disillusioning to those who thought, well, this was just done for strategic or, I guess, both tactical purposes to buy time and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, the intelligence capability that the Soviets had and the penetration of Europe, the United States, at a time when it wasn't so important because we weren't really in the Cold War. It was more to spy on, you know, Britain and France and the Western European nations. But I mean, the talent at the disposal of this regime was extraordinary. And, you know, again, that makes me very on guard when people start to talk about sort of history in teleological terms, that there is an arc and we are following it. And don't worry, if things look a little bit rough now, they'll turn out well in the end. I, you know, if you click rewind on this conflict and play it back, it doesn't actually necessarily have to turn out the way that it did.
That's true. The Western tradition does believe in progress. That's Old Testament, New Testament, the Enlightenment, the Whig conception of history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all of it. That's us. And Americans are like that on steroids. That doesn't mean that progress is inevitable, because it isn't. But as Americans, we haven't been wrong to bet on progress. When I was in graduate school, it was an article of faith that the division of Europe was permanent. The Iron Curtain was permanent. And through the early 1980s, there were still a lot of people who thought we were losing the Cold War. And you're right, it could have turned out badly for us, but it didn't. Because our institutions, no matter how many blunders we made and mistakes along the way, democracy really was the better system. Now, there is, in the 80s, you don't remember, you're too young, we assumed Japan was going to conquer all. Now it's China. Not sure in either case. I think the Chinese may have be hitting the wall of, you know, the authoritarian income trap. You can only go so far unless you make your country a rule of law country. I'm not a China expert, but I've never quite bought those who said that modernizing authoritarians had the secret to perpetual prosperity. They remind me too much of the idiot Americans and West Europeans who went to Stalin's Soviet Union and said, aha, it's all wonderful. You know, including one of the weaker U.S. ambassadors, Davies, yeah. Of course.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, what you're arguing against is inevitabilism, right? Which is, I think, a very good, fair-minded disposition to have. So it is not inevitable that, you know, an authoritarian superpower that has managed to sort of rid itself of certainly the centralized economy trappings is going to take over the world, right? I mean, we're getting into this sort of teleological frame of mind that I think is unhelpful and also dangerous. But let me ask you this.
That's right.
Because one of the things we talk about a lot is, well, okay, the original Cold War is over. The Soviet Union is no more. We just spent a while talking about the expansion of NATO and the spread of democratization and Europeanization to countries that were formerly under the Soviet yoke. We hear a lot in Washington, and I've heard a lot in Washington, including from members of this administration, look, we know that Russia is a nuisance. We know Putin is a bad guy. We know he's going around murdering dissidents and enemies. But at the end of the day, this is a declining power, one we have to have a transactional relationship with, be on guard cybersecurity wise. You know, let's do some sanctions here to keep them from marching into Narva or whatever the hell the day's logic has to hold. But the real thing is going to be China. This is our next 25-year strategic doctrine. Now, I know that you're very much opposed to this, and I want to hear this point of view. But one of the things that we were discussing was this David Ignatius column that came out last week, citing a senior administration official who I think I got wrong which one it was. Oh, actually, no, things are going to be okay now. We're going to do a deal with Russia on cybersecurity. I remember when Donald Trump tweeted that we should have a cybersecurity compact with Russia in the midst of his denying that Russia had actually hacked into the Democratic Party emails to try and sway a U.S. presidential election, that this was treated as the, you know, the most risible thing, well, since 5 minutes before when Donald Trump had done the most risible thing ever. But now we're hearing it from the adults in the room, you know, the good guys who've come back to power. And it, to me, look, I always said, and I was very worried about this, you know, I spent the last 5 years watching MSNBC and reading correct thinking liberal news outlets that had rightly so cottoned on to the threat of Russia. And I've been banging the drum about this and reporting about this for a very long time under Obama. And I was opposed to the reset, perhaps for different reasons that you were. And certainly when the Syria crisis broke out and we essentially acquiesced to direct Russian military intervention, which turned the tide in favor of Bashar al-Assad, all these things had exercised me more than most. I said, set your watch, because the minute a Democratic administration comes back into power is the minute we're going to stop hearing Rachel Maddow sound like Whitaker Chambers, and everybody's going to go back to the status quo ante of, oh, those dastardly neocons. I mean, John McCain is no longer with us, but, you know, John McCain wants to go to war with Russia. It's like, we need to de-escalate the rhetoric. And it's going to be like the last 5 years were just completely memory hold. It never happened, right? Mueller report was anticlimactic for so many, and therefore let's just move on and treat Russia again. A transactional power, maybe not a reset in name, but, you know, some kind of accommodation. Let's do business. We'll have a summit. We'll do this. We'll do that and the other. Tell me why this is wrong, why this is misguided policy. The institution Dan Fried must speak on the subject.
Okay. I understand why the Biden administration thinks China is the larger challenge for the 21st century, and I think they're right. It is understandable that they would want a stable and predictable, that's the term, relationship with Putin in similar fashion to Obama. It's understandable. The trouble is, it doesn't matter what they. Putin is not going and doesn't want a stable and predictable relationship with us. He needs to defeat and destroy Ukrainian independence. I don't mean conquer Ukraine de jure. I mean run it, because a democratic rule of law Ukraine, if it emerges, is going to destroy the basis of Russian autocracy, right? Ukraine's still mostly a Russian-speaking country, largely, though not entirely, Pravoslavny, Eastern Orthodox. And Russians are going to look around at Ukrainians. If Ukrainians follow basically the Polish path of massive prosperity because of reforms, now Ukrainians aren't there yet, but don't say they can't get there. They're having trouble. But even if they don't go as fast as Poland, if they move like Romania, slower, more zigs and zags, it's the end of Putinism. How about Belarus? Belarusians want democracy. If they have it, aren't Russians going to demand it? Therefore, Putin can't lose Belarus. Therefore, he will take steps that Americans will find it hard to countenance. Moreover, his repression internally involving murder, assassinations, is driving the Russian economy to stagnation and driving the regime to commit acts that Americans will find it hard to ignore. Russia under Putin is a spoiler country. It's going to attack us. It's been attacking us. You know, the Spanish thought Moscow's aggression had little to do with them until Moscow started fooling around in the Catalonia referendum.
More than that. I mean, 29155, you know, the GRU special task unit.
Yes.
Some of the bulk of their travel patterns is to Spain, and nobody knows why. It's not just for the Catalan referendum. God knows what else they're getting up to there.
All right, take Greece. Traditionally, they see themselves culturally as close to Russia. And yet the Russians start fooling around in Thessaloniki with when the Greek government decides to make peace with North Macedonia. And the Greeks were pissed. So it doesn't matter that the Biden administration wants a stable and predictable relationship with Russia. They are unlikely to get it. I'm not arguing against trying to cooperate where it's possible, but one, keep your expectations under control, and two, don't pay for cooperation by giving away your other interests. You have to be...
You know, on the surface, I could say, capitulating to Nord Stream 2.
And yeah, while we're on the subject, right now, Putin is using gas and threatening Europe, okay?
And gee, who could have seen that coming? This is what I mean. You know, we live through... This is not even old history. You don't have to go back into the stacks and blow the dust off the book here. Within living memory, this has happened.
Here's how I read the Biden administration. And this is not based on people whispering in my ear. Okay, this is my reading as from the outside. There are a lot of people in the Biden administration, like the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, like Tory Nuland, the Undersecretary, Karen Donfried, the Assistant Secretary, who are pretty tough-minded. And I know this because I work with them after 2014. And they were the people who gave me the backing I needed to go out and negotiate sanctions with the Europeans, which were a lot tougher than anybody thought we could get. My sense is that the people in the Biden administration who want to focus first on China are able to play this out. But when Putin acts in a way that blows this framework apart, the framework of park Russia, deal with China, I think they're beginning to realize they need to be ready. They can't be in a position of responding to some aggression by Putin by calling a quick process to come up with policy options. No, man, you have to have those options ready. And you have to let the Russians know that you have them. That is the kind of deterrence you need. And you need to work with Europe on a common approach. And to say that we need Russia against China is to misunderstand the nature of the Russo-Chinese relationship and to misunderstand the nature of our relations with Europe.
It reminds me of the old line that, well, if only we could separate Russia from Iran in the Middle East, then that would be, which by the way, that was Michael Flynn. I mean, before he really went doo-dah, that was what he was selling. And that was the basis of his going to Moscow. And, you know, it was all the war. Everybody thinks they can pull the Russians away from the entities and interests and nations that Russia is strategically wedded to, not out of any kind of shared ideological conceit, but perforce because they want to be ranged against the West. This is their goal. Even if Russia wanted to fuck up Iran's spot in Syria, they couldn't afford to do it because Iran is carrying the weight on the ground.
In my view, the right Russia policy includes the biggest pillar, resisting Putin's aggression. A second pillar, cooperating where possible, but not at the expense of the need to resist Putin's aggression. And three, invest in a better relationship with a better Russia. Reach out to Russian society. Reach out to civil society. Don't assume that the Kremlin is the only option. That's a long-term investment. You know, on Twitter today, I saw somebody make a mischievous suggestion that for every oligarch we sanction, we ought to give 100 visas to ordinary Russians come to the U.S. Not a bad thought. The notion, in a cute kind of Twitter way, is reach out to Russian society and invest in that. It'll take a long time.
I want to put this to you because, again, you have sanctions is your expertise. And, you know, one of the things that I've spent a long time reporting on and investigating is kleptocracy and corruption. And whenever you kind of dig into some Russia-related story, you invariably find out that where the money laundering is taking place, it ain't Russian Federation territory. Right? It's the UK. It's the Baltic states. It's Switzerland. It's the United States. Now, you and I both know that, and this became the stuff of caricature and parody, and for good reasons, there was a list of people, oligarchs, if you want to call them that, businessmen, I would call them billionaire plenipotentiaries of the regime, because that is the role that they fulfill. They corrupt and taint with their resources Western markets, society, institutions by appearing as private businessmen. But in fact, I mean, they work for the regime. There was a list of people. We can speculate and probably, you know, play a fun parlor game guessing who was on it. Never really released, though. State Department sits on this thing. And this is a list of names. If I had to spitball, I would say Abramovich. I would say Usmanov. I would say all the big bad guys that do this, that own the sports clubs and the chateaus and the chalets and you know, do deals with Western real estate companies and all the rest of it. And the US says, well, we're not going to sanction these guys because this is the list that we will use as a deterrent. This is what, these are the guys we'll start to go after, pick them off one by one vis-a-vis sanctions, if and when Putin decides to escalate. Now, I understand from a foreign policy kind of realpolitik point of view, the logic behind that. But as somebody who says, we cannot really, in good faith, lecture Russia or any country. We can't bang on about corruption and kleptocracy unless we get our own house in order. This to me is very cynical, right? We know that these guys are dirty. We know what they get up to. We know that the role that they're playing, as I previously described, and yet we're not going after them for its own sake, for the sake of greater transparency, and for the sake of cleaning up dirty, dark money in the Western financial system. We're keeping this in reserve in case Putin invades another country, right? Yeah. Explain why.
Okay, here's my answer. You've already suggested the proper path forward, which is it is not a sanction. It is not punishment. It is not directed at Russia. For us, the United States and the UK and the EU and other G7 countries to clean up our act, by which I mean stop the practice of money laundering through high-end real estate, hidden LLCs, art, some kinds of law firms and other hidden ways, trust funds, other ways that people hide their money. Knock it off. Reveal this stuff and make it hard for money laundering to take place. We all have to do it together. London real estate, but New York and Miami real estate. Banks in Europe, banks in Washington. In New York. We have to do this together. And there's been a lot of interest in the Hill. Tom Malinowski, congressman, Democrat from New Jersey, reelected second term, has introduced a bill to this effect, and it's got bipartisan support. The Biden administration during the campaign was pushing this hard. A colleague of mine at German Marshall Fund, Josh Rudolph, has written about this in great detail. It's not a sanction. So I would take your problem of this list of Russian oligarchs, and I am painfully familiar with that whole saga. And I would say, as an old bureaucrat, divide your problem. One problem is sanctioning Russian oligarchs. The other problem is cleaning up our financial system. And those are different. Those are different problems.
But America can only, in theory, clean up its own. It cannot do anything about Britain's. It cannot do anything about France.
We can do a lot if we're working with the British and the EU. You put this top front and center of the agenda. Okay. Already, the Biden administration has put anti-corruption as the most kind of concrete, granular agenda item on its summit of democracies process. I know this sounds uber wonky, but that's how stuff gets done. The US-EU Trade and Technology Council has a broad and still open mandate. Well, one of the things they can do is set common standards for financial transparency. And if the US and EU get together and do this, we have basically set global standards. We can enforce this stuff. What the Biden administration should do is take Treasury's financial integrity unit and beef it up the way we did sanctions, starting with Bush and then under Obama. This is uber wonky, but if you want to translate Michael Weiss's outrage at these abuses, and you're quite right, if you want to translate it into policy, you got to go down the wonk road, because that's how it happens. We can do this.
The value of sanctions to me as a journalist is, it's tantamount to sort of the FBI concept of gray mailing. You know what somebody's guilty of, right? You can't bring them to book because doing so would compromise how you know what you know, in most cases through classified intelligence. So instead, you get them on other things, right? The minute the U.S. government issues sanctions against whether it's an oligarch or a company or a bank, I had a PR war with VTB for several months after doing a report into their dirty money laundering. And it was always white shoe law firms in London, PR firms that are hired by these guys to kind of go to war with you and send nasty letters to your editor. As a journalist, sanctions create an instant pariah effect, and they also create a kind of informational immunity. Prigozhin just recently said, I'd love to sue Bellingcat in British High Court, but I can't because I've been sanctioned by the UK. Excellent. Excellent.
Yes. I remember. My team, we got the Prigozhin sanctions through in December 2016. I was really proud of that work. It's important to enjoy your day job.
Hey, my favorite was still the first slate of them where, you know, Gunvor, another Swiss commodities trader, which very much on my radar. And what's buried in that sanctions packet? Putin has direct access to cash in a Swiss commodities trade. I mean, the late Karen Dawisha, I mean, Catherine Bell, I mean, all of us who have been saying for years, all of a sudden the imprimatur of the United States government had certified that indeed Putin himself is a kleptocrat who's keeping money in the perfidious West that he wants to go to war with.
Well, you know, if you're talking about a long-term policy toward Russia, remember I said the third pillar was invest in a better Russia and exchanges and reaching out to civil society. The other part of that is exposing Putin's wealth and corruption.
But the U.S. government is in a better position to help American civil society and journalism do that. And by the way, there's nothing cynical or untoward about this. This is just transparency.
Well, that's right. And we shouldn't apologize. And it also applies to China. There ought to be the transparency also ought to include investment. We ought to know who's buying. Look, one of the rules of life is always know who's buying the drinks. Okay. Always know who's investing in your country. We have the United States government has a system for national security screenings of investments.
Right.
Which works pretty well. Other countries should get it too.
Well, I mean, banks are meant to have know your client protocols, but how many of them actually enforce them?
Well, you know, you're going to don't trust banks and businesses to do what's right because it costs them money. Trust them to do what's right when the alternative lands them in big trouble.
Mm.
Now, that's the kind of incentive structure I like. Look, this isn't, you know, Teddy Roosevelt had this figured out. You use the power of the federal government to get the big boys to play straight, or they won't play straight. It's not socialism. It's American progressivism. You know, the original tradition. It's a great tradition. Bring it back. I think Biden's all there. That's the good side of his administration. I mean, and it's pretty good.
And, you know, to bring this full circle, I have to be honest with you. I mean, one of the reasons you see the wind beneath the sails of populism, both on the right and on the left, is this widely held perception. It's not just a perception, it's a reality that the system is deeply corrupted, right? We are not simply by not enforcing our own laws against money laundering, against tax evasion, against a whole suite of financial crimes, allowing people with way too much money to begin with to amass more of it at the expense of everybody else who, you know, goes around paying their taxes,
okay,
or not stealing money from other people or institutions. You know, this is the little guy raging out against all of the things that were sold to him as being very much above board and the best of all possible worlds, right?
This is why Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal was such a success. It addressed these concerns and did so when the United States was challenged by Stalinism and fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And after World War II, we applied the notion of the New Deal that you could regulate your way to a more just world. We tried to apply this to global capitalism to avoid the destructive impact of boom and bust cycles in the Great Depression. Well, when Tony Blinken or President Biden start talking about strengthening the rules-based order under the rubric of the American liberal rules-based system to deal with 21st century challenges, this is the tradition they're calling on, okay? That's Biden. He's 10 years older than I am, for God's sake. For him, Roosevelt is not ancient history.
Right.
And that actually worked pretty well. So when you were talking about going after Putin's system through transparency and good government, that's the American way, at least it was in the years of our wisdom. It's the strategic ethical underpinning of Truman, Roosevelt, Wilson before them, and Abraham Lincoln, you know, who believed in capitalism and the use of government to help people who were otherwise getting screwed.
The law and liberty tradition.
Well, there it is. I mean, this isn't original to me.
No. And you know, to be honest, like, look, with all due respect to France and President Macron, you know, one of the things that has been proposed, and actually I think McCain was a proponent of it, and Robert Conquest gave it its fullest definition or expression in academic form, was the so-called Anglosphere, right? You know, shared cultural values, the law and liberty tradition, where, I mean, Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand should be kind of leaders, global leaders in cleaning up these sort of the financial markets, revivifying democratic institutions and liberalism with a small L. This is the sort of consensus upon which all of these societies and these forms of government are based.
Well, although I will say this, don't forget the Enlightenment is also French, Montesquieu, and don't forget Immanuel Kant.
No, I'm not saying that America does not have alliances or partnerships with other countries, but...
No, but liberalism is not just Anglosphere.
That's true.
Yes, the French have a statist tradition, but that's not the whole of it. Look, this is all hopeful stuff because it suggests that we have within ourselves as societies the tools we need to deal with the authoritarians, the Chinas and the Russias. The trouble is, and the Biden administration is discovering this, it's one thing to have the right ideas and it's another thing to apply them in practice. And that's where they've been falling short, but they know it. There is no strategy that is protection against stupid, okay? Like the Oxus deal, you know, the Australian submarine deal. That's just malpractice. It's just so dumb.
So what would you have done differently, assuming you would have gone ahead and...
Well, I think the deal was basically right. You don't rub the French nose in it. For example, what you do is get the Australians to tell the French they decided to go with a nuclear sub and they're going to have a new tender. And then a few months later, you know, there's a new tender and the U.S. picks it up. The French aren't dumb. They're going to figure out what happened, but you won't have humiliated them in public, for God's sakes. Well, what's wrong with us? And I think I know.
How did that get so cocked up?
Oh, I think it's not hard to guess. It's after Afghanistan. We really want to win. This deal is long in the making and it's complicated. The Asianists are driving it forward. They can see it. It's a great deal. Just push it through. Big arms deal. Knowledge of this was probably restricted to a very small group of people. When it was briefed a little more widely, maybe the Europeanists were involved. There was no Karen Dunford, no assistant secretary. You know, there were only a few who would have been briefed with an interest in Europe. Do I think one of them raised their hand? Yeah, probably. And they were crushed. They were overruled because we were so close to a deal we needed. Do you think the proponents told President Biden that he'd have to make an apology call to Macron? Not likely. They probably said the French will squawk and get over it.
Well, they squawk. I don't think they're going to get over it, though.
Well,
but this begs the question, why is the president not himself aware of these things, given his long history of being a foreign policy politician?
Because it's always harder in government. Look, I told you how I think it happened, and that's not based on special knowledge.
Right.
That's just based on long general knowledge of how these things work. And I've seen this stuff before. I've seen this movie. They screwed up. They shouldn't have been so hungry. The fact that they were hungry is understandable, but that's not good enough. And the hardest thing, you asked how it got cocked up. You know why I think? The hardest thing in government is not to put together a drive through a package, a proposal. The hardest thing is to look at that proposal, a nice, shiny package, a Christmas present you really want to open, and to look past it, look around the corner and say, okay, what's wrong with this pretty picture? That is goddamn hard.
Mm.
That's the skill you need in those senior jobs, to always look around the corners and make those judgments. And I saw the Bush administration before Iraq and after Iraq. Boy, did they learn how to look around corners after that.
Well, that, you know, this is the argument for putting people in policy positions who have been burnt by history.
Yes.
And by unforeseen events. But that also says that actually, you know, bright young things and wunderkinds who, you know, attend all the finest Ivy League schools and, you know, with the toast of their IR class and all the rest of it, aren't necessarily the best place to face off against somebody like a Patrushev.
You need a mix.
Yeah.
You need a mix. You know, I'm an old guy, right?
Well, you wouldn't be an institution if you were a young guy.
And
right?
I've seen a lot of policies work. That's right. I'm an old guy and I've seen policies work and I've seen policies fail. I don't want the government staffed by people like me. I want it staffed by a mixture of people. And that's what works.
It was a pleasure. Dan Fried, we will absolutely have you back on. You've been listening to Foreign Office. I'm Michael Weiss, and we will see you next time.